This morning we're going to be talking about the situation in Judea, politically speaking, after the death of Herod the Great. In order that we can appreciate what happened at that point in time, we need to have a sort of genealogical chart of the progeny of Herod the Great. These were the sons that Herod the Great had. I told you there were a lot of Herods in his family. They liked that name. I mean, Herod the Great's father's name was Herod too, remember? And there are two other Herods that are mentioned in the book of Acts as well from this family. This tended to be a very popular female name, too, because you not only have Herod's sister, who was Salome, but you also have his granddaughter, the son of the ruler of Galilee, whose name was Salome also. Remember the one of the seven veils. Two of the names sort of stick out as not quite belonging to the group, because... And they are very popular names in the Hasmonean family. And those were the two sons that he had of his wife Mariamne, the Hasmonean princess. And that's why they bear, you know, more typically Hasmonean names. Herod, I think, had six wives, several at the same time. And so for the first time in ages, you have sort of a harem restored in Judea. Aristobulus IV and Alexander were executed on Herod's orders in 6 BC as part of his paranoia about a Hasmonean revival. As Herod lay dying, we presume around 4 BC, apparently it seemed he suffered a weakening, and it seemed to indicate he was on the verge of death. And apparently the word left the palace and went to his oldest son, Herod, that... so you've got four Herods. What can I do? So you know which one I'm talking about. This oldest son, Herod, was named Antipater, or nicknamed Antipater, after the grandfather, since he was the oldest of Herod the Great's children. Anyway, news reached him. He was in Ptolemais, which today is modern-day Acco, or the Crusader city of Acre, if you know where that is on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And he heard from somebody at the court that his father was on the verge of death and could never possibly recover, and it was just a matter of maybe hours or days before he would succumb. And so he began to, let's say, celebrate his impending succession. And unfortunately for him, Herod recovered and got wind of what had happened and felt that was particularly disloyal in his son, so he had him executed too. Which is unfortunate in a way, because he was probably the most capable of Herod's sons. So he executed his most capable heir. He did die approximately in 4 BC, though not at that point. He rallied and then died later. Leaving three sons that survived him. So these were the surviving sons of Herod, all of whom were named Herod. Now, in order to tell them apart, we call the oldest of the three surviving sons Herod Archelaus. Well, that was a name, actually. He bore sort of a nickname. Then the other one was also nicknamed Philip. Herod Philip, and that's the way he's referred to in the New Testament, is Philip. And then there was Herod Antipas. Now, when Herod died, under the arrangements of his alliance with Rome, he had the right to nominate his successor by making a will. But it was up to the Roman government to decide, you know, whether to accept the will or impose some different solution of their own. And unfortunately, Herod left two wills. One left everything to his oldest surviving son, Herod Archelaus, and he expressed the desire that he should succeed him as king of Judea. The second will divided up the territory of Judea into four pieces, one for Herod Archelaus, one for Herod Philip, one for Herod Antipas, and one for his sister Salome. And the Romans decided to accept the second will for several reasons. One, they didn't feel it was wise to antagonize the other children of Herod because they knew that the second will had existed. And therefore, they'd feel, well, the Romans did us dirty. They chose the one that gave everything to Archelaus and left us out in the cold with nothing. And remember, this is a border province of the Roman dominion. Although the Parthians never did invade the east again, the eastern borders of the Roman Empire, they didn't know that wouldn't be the case. I mean, that we can look back in history and see it never happened. But they always were alert to any moment the Parthians could invade. They wanted to maintain stability and strength on their eastern border. And so it didn't seem to be a wise idea to antagonize these other children of Herod and maybe cause them to conspire with the Parthians about having an invasion. The second reason was is that they sort of left the door open with an incentive for Archelaus to sort of improve his situation. Because as you can see from the way they divided things up, they gave Archelaus the lion's share, you might say, of the territory. They gave him Judea, Samaria, and Idumea. And they allowed him to enjoy the title of ethnarch of Judea, with the idea that if he proved his capabilities and loyalty, they would allow him to call himself king of Judea later. Herod Philip received the area called Golanitis, and in fact the name is still preserved today in this region. This is the present-day Golan area of Syria, or since because of its geographical situation, it's called the Golan Heights, which Israel is currently occupying. Then Herod Antipas received two territories. The one that is more important, of course, is the Galilee. But he also received Perea, which was part of his jurisdiction, this area across the Jordan River that you see there. Then the fourth heir was Herod the Great's sister Salome, who received some coastal territory and also some territory right around the city of Jericho. Phasaelis, near the Jordan River. And then some of Herod's territory became independent. You see, there was an established city-state of Ascalon and a city-state of Gaza, independent city-states that had nothing anymore to do with Herod's dominion. Now, since the Romans approved the division of Herod the Great's territory into four parts, the one who had the lion's share was called the ethnarch. The title enjoyed by the other three was the title tetrarch. This is the word that appears in the Gospels describing Herod Antipas, the ruler of Galilee. He is called the tetrarch of Galilee. And you may have wondered, well, you know, what does that title mean? Where did it ever come from? Well, it comes from the Greek root tetra. But actually, when you count in Greek, you go anadia tria tessera, which is slight variation on it. Tetra meaning four or a fourth. And so therefore, he was ruler over a fourth of the territory. And that's where the title comes from. Now, we have to understand the nature of these things. Judea was a state unto itself, consisting of three parts: Samaria, Judea in the center, Idumea in the south. But the whole thing was called Judea. Galilee was an independent territory. It was not part of Judea. It was a completely separate territory with its own ruler, its own administration, its own responsibilities towards Rome. The area of Golanitis was again an independent territory, as was the territory of Salome. This is important that we remember this because in 6 AD, this date we know with certainty, There were simultaneous rebellions in Judea, Idumea, and Samaria against the rule of Archelaus. As far as the people were concerned, the last part of his name is the way they looked at him. And they weren't very happy, therefore, under his rule, and they revolted. Now, again, what was the bottom line as far as the Romans were concerned? What is it they wanted more than anything else from their associated rulers? Mr. Flamen? Right. Archelaus failed to deliver that. Consequently, he was exiled, I think, to Lyon in France, and not thrown into a prison. They gave him a nice villa and a suitable supply of servants and a little bit of a pension to live on. But they wanted him out of the area, you know, because he had proved himself to be incompetent. And then the area that Archelaus had ruled became a Roman province, known as the Roman province of Judea. Now, this is what we have to focus on, is this whole area was not the Roman province of Judea. Only the part that Archelaus had ruled. Galilee continued to be independent, being ruled by Herod Antipas, as Tetrarch of Galilee. The Gaulonitis continued to be independent, ruled by Philip. The territories of Salome remained independent, ruled by Salome. The only thing that came under direct Roman rule was the area that Archelaus had mishandled and which became known as the Roman province of Judea, or Judea, if you like that pronunciation better. Now, this change in the political situation was crucial. I say it was crucial because it was necessary to fulfill prophecy. Without Archelaus losing control of this area, prophecy could not have been fulfilled. Because it remained a Roman province. Judea remained a Roman province from 6 AD to, I believe it was 37. No, that's not right either. Let me get this straight. 41 AD. And then for a period of years thereafter, it was independent again in the 40s AD. And then it became a Roman province again. Now, why is it important that Judea was a Roman province in this period of time? In what way was prophecy could not have been fulfilled unless it had been a Roman province? Joey? Right. He might have been stoned. He might have been killed in some other fashion. But if Archelaus had been an independent ruler of Judea, he certainly would not have been crucified. He would have died in some other way, either by stoning, beheading, some other fashion. He would have been dispatched, probably by stoning, though. That's the most likely way he would have been executed. Now, that, of course, would have violated the prophesied form of his death, because it said that not a bone would be broken. Now, if you stone somebody, you break quite a few bones. You see, that would have broken that. Even if you cut off their head, you break bones. So it was necessary to fulfill prophecy that Jesus be crucified. And that would only have taken place if Judea had been a Roman province at the time of his death. Now, we need to understand the general pattern of Roman administration. The Roman provinces were of two types. You had what were called the public provinces, which were ruled by the Senate, and you had the imperial provinces that were ruled by Augustus, and later, of course, by Tiberius. Now, Augustus and Tiberius reserved for their own direct rule provinces that were new to the empire, had just been added, provinces that had a history of rebellion and therefore required a stronger, more direct supervision by the emperor, and provinces that were on the border of the Roman Empire. And so you can understand that Judea would obviously be an imperial province because it met all three of those criteria. It was on the border, it was new, and it also had a history of very recent rebellion. So, for all three of those reasons, Judea became an imperial province. And the way imperial provinces were structured is you had a governor, somebody who was sent out by the emperor to govern the place. And the governor would be assisted by a staff that he would bring out with him from Rome. Now, in his staff, typically he would include some relatives if they were competent, in order to give them maybe a leg up in the civil service and get them going on a public career. And if he had any very close friends in Rome who had aspiring sons, he might take some of them along, you know, so they could get some training, practical training in the field, and maybe qualify for a position of governor on their own. So he had a support staff. Now, as governor, he had two major areas of responsibility in the province. He was responsible for the province in terms of military responsibilities and judicial. Those were his two areas of responsibility. In terms of his military responsibilities, a governor of an imperial province was in charge of the legions, which means the official Roman army that were stationed in the province. He was also in charge of the auxiliary troops. These would be non-Romans recruited from the local population. Now, the legions were, of course, the main military force. The auxiliary troops performed more of a police function, like a police force. They were the ones in day-to-day contact with the population. The legions were stationed in various camps and barracks, and they would only be there to come out and have contact with the population if, you know, there was a need, if there was a rebellion, you see, or insurrection, or some other major problem that required their being employed. But normal police functions, bringing the troops into day-to-day contact with the population, was related to the auxiliary troops. And there was a certain beauty in this system, because I'm talking now in the generality. The foreign Roman troops were kept in the background as much as possible so they didn't irritate the people of the province. The people that they had most contact with, who were, you know, performing some sort of a military or police function, were their own people, you see, recruited into the auxiliary forces, and therefore there would be less tension. First of all, these troops would probably deal with the people in a little more sensitive manner, less overbearing manner, and the people would not be quite as resentful because at least they were their own people. Now, in terms of the judicial function, as governor, you might say he was the final Supreme Court, court of appeal within the province, for all civil and criminal judicial matters. And so that's basically the responsibilities of the government, with the governor, of course, as the chief executive and commander-in-chief of the military forces, and he has his two different types of troops that he is responsible for, and he has the responsibility of being over the civil and criminal court system. And of course, with the help of his staff, he's responsible for making administrative policy. Now again, in order that the provinces should not become too restive, the governors try to be involved in day-to-day administration as little as possible. The governor made the overall policy, but he didn't actually dig in with the day-to-day contact with the people in governing them. What they had was another group responsible to the governor of local government officials. They took orders from the governor. They were responsible to the governor for the day-to-day effectual administration of the country. They were also responsible most directly for maintaining peace and stability in the province. It was their job, as I say, to carry out day-to-day administration and it was their job to maintain stability. Now, their responsibility in maintaining stability was they had the right to command certain of the troops, you see, as necessary just to maintain a normal kind of stability. They were allowed to draw upon these troops. They had certain units assigned to them. But not only did they have certain units of troops, but their most important responsibility in terms of maintaining stability was to watch out for and identify quickly and hand over quickly any individuals who seemed to be fomenting rebellion. So they had to keep their ear to the ground, you might say, and their finger on the pulse of the country. So if they sensed a growing restiveness among the people, they had to identify who seemed to be the ringleaders of that restiveness, grab them, and hand them over to the Romans to be executed. That was their job. Now, why do you say was this their burden? Because the Romans felt better the people get angry at them than get angry directly at the Romans. Even though the Romans, of course, are responsible, the people tend to focus more of their direct anger at their own leaders, you see. So they had to identify and hand over apparent rebel leaders. Now that's now the picture of a typical Roman imperial province, which we now have to begin to apply to the case of Judea. And as I say, as we begin to do this, I think you may even pick up some hints of how this begins to relate to the situation of Jesus, and we will have to come back and review this as we go through the arrest and trial of Jesus to understand why things were happening as they were happening, you see. Okay, let's apply this in the case of Judea. You'll have to start with another chart. What I suggest you do is you put in all the major headings, like governor, staff, military, judicial, legions, auxiliary troops, civil, criminal, local government officials, but none of this other explanatory material, because this is going to be different in the case of Judea. Judea always seemed to be a problem for whatever foreign power governed it, every time after the Persians, you might say, because the Jews were just different. And because of their differences, they could not be ruled in the typical bureaucratic fashion. Various exceptions had to be made. And in the case of the Jews of Judea, there were exceptions in the case of the legions, in the case of the auxiliary troops, in the case of civil and criminal justice. There were quite notable exceptions that were made in the way Judea was handled. Now, part of it, most of this was due to the uniqueness of the Jews. Part of it happened to do just with the physical setting of Judea itself. Now let's take a look and see what some of these exceptions were. In the case of the legions, which were normally stationed in an imperial province, very few legions were stationed in Judea. Very few. It was a small province, first of all. Plus, Judea was located between Syria and Egypt, where they already had major concentrations of troops. Therefore, if there was a problem in Judea, the governor there could rely on the massive concentrations of troops in Syria or Egypt, which were not so terribly far away. And so Judea actually had very few legions. Secondarily, under the military, we now have the auxiliary troops. Normally, the auxiliary troops were recruited from the local dominant population. to minimize friction with that population. This could not be done in Judea, because first of all, the Jews, going back to the days of Julius Caesar, had been granted exemption from such service. Therefore, the only people that the governor could recruit for the auxiliary troops were the Hellenized elements in Judean society, the Hellenized non-Jewish elements then formed the auxiliary troops in Judea. And not particularly being sympathetic to the Jews, since they were looked down upon by the Jews, they tended to treat the Jewish population in a rather rough fashion. Sort of the way now they're in charge over them, they're going to make these Jews pay, you know, for their haughtiness and senses of superiority and so on. And so the auxiliary troops were not drawn from the majority Jewish population. They were drawn from the minority Hellenistic population, and they tended to work out their frustrations against the Jews and their anger against the Jews and the way they carried out their functions. In the case of the governor's civil and criminal judicial functions, most cases could not be decided according to Roman principles of law in Judea, because the Jews had a divinely inspired legal code that they felt obliged to follow. Therefore, when Jews were involved, in almost all cases, the cases were decided according to Jewish law in Jewish courts. They never entered the Roman courts. The only exceptions would be under civil cases when one party to a suit was a Roman citizen. When one party of the suit was a Roman citizen, the Roman citizen could insist that the case be tried in the governor's court. In the case of criminal charges, the only exceptions, when again a Roman citizen is involved, the case would be tried in a Roman court at the Roman citizen's request. He could choose to be tried in the Jewish court if it was all right with him, or he could insist on being tried in the Roman court. And this may relate to something you know about, instance not specifically associated with Jesus, but later on with Paul. Or something came under the criminal jurisdiction of the governor if it was a case of treason. Those were the only two situations when the governor became involved in a criminal case, which raises an interesting question. The governor is certainly involved in Jesus' case. That tells you immediately why he was involved, doesn't it? Should. Because there are only two possibilities that would explain why the governor would be involved in his case. Was Jesus a Roman citizen? No. So therefore, he was involved for the other reason, which is a very important point that we'll have to pick up on when we go through the events of his arrest and his trial. Okay. In the case of Judea, who were the local government officials that carried out the day-to-day administration? Well, who would you expect to be involved? Who would the Romans naturally turn to be sort of the overall in charge of the local administration? Mark? Mm-hmm. And which one? Who's the most natural candidate? Right? The high priest, as the most influential single official in Judea, would be a logical choice to be entrusted with the responsibility of the day-to-day administration. And for another reason, because in the case of Judea, much of the legal responsibilities dealt with religious law. Obviously, he would need to be involved. So the high priest was over two subsections of the local administration. And again, we're going to use these terms, the Synhedrin and the Sanhedrin. The Synhedrin that carried out administrative policy, the Sanhedrin that carried out judicial functions. The scribes were sitting in the Sanhedrin and were the experts on oral and written law, so therefore judicial cases could be decided in accordance with the Torah and the unwritten Torah. The Synhedrin, of course, again, capable administrative type priests and large landowners who had administrative experience would be assisting the high priest in carrying out the day-to-day administration of the province of Judea. And these groups then were responsible to the governor for day-to-day functioning on an efficient manner, and of course for spotting, identifying, and turning over potential rebels against the Romans. And so this is the setup that we have. Now, in order to make sure that the high priesthood did not become too powerful in office and that it was very clear who was really running things, it was not uncommon for the governor to change high priests. And that's something we have to keep in mind when we get to the time of the trial of Jesus, is that there were frequent changes of high priests. It was not an inherited office or even held for life. It was frequently done. Now, one thing we could turn to right here, the Romans would never have dared to interfere in the selection of the high priests if there hadn't been a long historical precedent for political overlords of the Jews to have done so. You see, the loss of the independence of the high priesthood in the days of Onias III and Jason and Menelaus, that provided the powerful precedents that the Romans could claim for manipulating the high priesthood. The fact that Herod the Great had manipulated it himself more recently, of course, gave them even more support to their ability to do it. If that high priesthood had never been tampered with, the Romans would have backed off and never interfered in the selection process. Because when they came into an area, they always respected the deeply entrenched local traditions and customs, lest they rile the people unnecessarily. But you see, there was no such problem in Judea because the high priesthood had become sort of a political position anyway, manipulated by the ruler for a long time. Okay, this then gives you the essential differences. I only need to mention one other feature which was different. Normally, the governor resided in the capital city of the province. Now, what was the capital of Judea? What had always been its capital? Jerusalem. In the case of Judea, the governor did not reside in the capital. The governor did not reside in Jerusalem. He did not reside there for several reasons. One, Jerusalem was a very sensitive place to the Jews because that's where their temple was. If he lived there with his Hellenistic Roman lifestyle, this would be offensive to the Jews. Consequently, he lived in a city that was built as a Hellenistic Roman city, with all the accoutrements to make him comfortable. A city that had bathhouses, forum, gymnasia, race course. What's the word I'm thinking for now? Amphitheater for various dramatic entertainments. He lived in Caesarea, which is no surprise because if you remember the book of Acts, that when Paul meets the Roman governor, where is he? He's in Caesarea. You see, there's no mystery about that, if you remember that from the book of Acts. Caesarea was also preferred as the governor's residence because being close to the Via Maris, it was on the main route between Egypt and Syria, so he could maintain better communication with the governors of Egypt and Syria and their legions in case he needed to call on them. If he stayed up in Jerusalem, he could be cut off and isolated very easily. Plus, by being at Caesarea, which was a great seaport built by King Herod, in fact, something that maybe we should pause and just mention, is that Herod built this seaport at Caesarea because there was no other good natural seaport on the whole coastline of Judea. It was a huge harbor and was a tremendously sophisticated harbor. To the extent, you know, all harbors tend to have a problem of silting up. Is that ingenious engineering design went into the seaport in such a way that they've now been, of course, excavating it through underwater archaeology. And they've uncovered the methods that were used to prevent it from silting up. And in the opinion of marine engineers, it is superior to any method used in a seaport in the world today. They did a remarkably fine job. It also featured underwater concrete, poured underwater, to create the barriers necessary to protect the ships when they were in port. Well, this very beautiful city with its magnificent seaport enabled him to maintain good communication by sea with Rome. So this was vital from his standpoint, too. Now, the governor never went near Jerusalem except once a year. What was the one time of the year when the governor came to Jerusalem? And you should all know. Some of you don't think you know, but you all know. So I can call on anybody, right? Roy Kustin. You have read the Gospels, haven't you? Is there any mention in the Gospels of the governor Pontius Pilate being in Jerusalem? If there is, you should be able to tell the time of the year he was there. I think you're going to feel foolish. For us? Right. Okay. Because we know that Jesus, when he was arrested, which was at the time of the Passover, was taken over to Pilate. So that's why he was there, right? He was in Jerusalem, so that's the season. Now, why was that the only season of the year that the governor troubled himself to go up to Jerusalem and risked, maybe you might say, offending the Jewish population by his pagan presence in the city? And what was the reason, the rationale, besides for him making that decision? Eric? Right. In other words, this was the celebration of their freedom from Egyptian slavery. They were afraid that maybe current-day Jews would make an analogy to their current condition as being equivalent to the Egyptian slavery, and therefore they'd be in a very restless, rebellious attitude, say, at that time. Plus, what else was a factor? Not just because it was the festival of freedom from Egypt, but what popular belief existed among the people that the governor had to take note of and do something about? Dan? Not return, but would appear. It was the folk belief, if you will, that the Messiah would declare himself, would openly declare himself to his people at the Passover season. So therefore, messianic fervor tended to run very high at the Passover season. And so it was felt to be wise for the Roman governor to come up, not just alone, but with his legions, to sort of impress upon the people, don't get out of hand. You know, if you do, we're here to crack skulls, and we will do so without any hesitation. So keep your tempers under control and don't get carried away. That was the reason why they came up. But otherwise, the governor stayed out of the way, lest he give offense in Caesarea. Okay, let's take a look at a few other features that we can relate to either the specific things with Jesus' ministry or with the general situation at the time of Jesus' arrest. I mentioned there were very few legions in Judea. Where do we find mention of anybody connected with a legion in the Gospels or the Book of Acts? Pedro? Right. Where was he? Well, there's two centurions. Okay. One of them is in Jerusalem in the Book of Acts. He's the one that takes charge of Paul. Remember when Paul was mobbed in the temple area? The centurion takes him in charge. Because they did maintain a small legionary force in a fortress right by the temple. The northwest corner of the temple, they had the Antonia Fortress. Why do you think they put a legion there? It may not have been a full legion, but it was certainly a fairly good-sized Roman military detachment. Yeah. Right. So therefore, it was good to have the Roman troops very close to hand so they could go down and crack heads if necessary and cool the people. You know, if they developed some sort of messianic fervor, it would probably start at the temple, you see, and spread from there. Where else do we read about a centurion? All right? Okay, very logical he'd be there, because that's where the Roman governor was. You see, when you read about them, there's no explanation in the Gospels why they're where they are. But if we stop and think, you know, of the circumstances, it becomes obvious why they are stationed where they are. Where else do we read about a centurion? Such faith I have not found in Israel. But who was the subject of that comment? Sophie? Right. Now, it might have been Cornelius who had been reassigned. Some have speculated it might have been. But there's no way of being certain it could have been a completely different individual. And where was that centurion living? Peter was at Joppa when the messengers came to him from Cornelius in Caesarea. Yes. Yeah. Now, notice on your map, where is Capernaum? It's not listed here, but it's near Bethesda, just across from Bethesda. And whose territory is that? Who was ruling that territory at the time Jesus was carrying out his ministry? Susie? Yeah. See, he is stationed in what is nominally an independent area. Why would the Romans have a legionary detachment in an independent client state, you know, outside of a Roman province? What function is he serving in that area? He obviously had been resident there for quite some time because he had become impressed enough with the Jews and their religion that he had decided to donate a synagogue to them and provide alms for the poor and so on in that area. Remember, the Jewish leaders begged Jesus to do something for him because he's a really good man. He's done a lot for them. You see, Capernaum is on the northern shore of Sea of Galilee, right to the left of where Bethesda is. Does that give you an idea? What does that make Capernaum, if it's just to the left of that dot of Bethesda? Bethsaida, I'm sorry. You keep mispronouncing it. If it's just to the left of that dot, what function does Capernaum serve? Oh, it's not that hard to read the map and draw the conclusion. Yes. Well, not necessarily, but it obviously has to be one thing. Look at the map. If it is almost touching the dot of Bethsaida, what is it? Eric? Yeah, it's on the border between Antipas' territory and Philip's. It is a frontier crossing point. It is there where people are coming back and forth, and therefore, just to kind of keep an eye on things, the Romans tended to take care of those things, which explains something else. Who's the person that Jesus, quote speak, recruited, much of the disparagement of people who felt he should have not bothered with this person in that particular place? Who came specifically from there that he recruited? Matthew. What was his profession? Not so much a tax collector alone, but a customs tax collector, because it was a border crossing point. It's where the customs were collected when you cross from one to the other, you see. So that's why the Romans like to keep an eye on activities such as that, and so they had a small contingent station there. Okay, the bell is rung. I don't think I'll go into any other situations. So we'll let you go.